Hey there, Next Wheel listeners, this is Andy. Before we dive into this episode, I wanted to let you know about an exciting change. As you may have noticed, we have been including episodes of one of our other shows, Movies We Like, in this feed. Well, we are thrilled to announce that Movies We Like has grown so much that it's now ready to strike out on its own. From now on, to catch the latest episodes of Movies We Like, you'll want to head over to its dedicated feed and hit that subscribe button. We've got plenty of other great content lined up, and we don't want you to miss a thing. Don't worry, though, the Next Reel Film Podcast isn't going anywhere. We'll still be bringing you the same in-depth discussions and analysis of your favorite films right here in this feed. So if you love what we do with Movies We Like, be sure to search for it in your favorite podcast app and subscribe today. Thanks for being a part of our podcast journey, and now let's get back to the show. Hey, listeners, it's Andy, and I'm here to see if you've tried Audible yet. With an incredible selection of audiobooks, it is the perfect way to dive deeper into the stories upon which some of your favorite films are based. Audible members get a credit every month to redeem on any audiobook they like, plus access to a huge Plus catalog of podcasts, originals, and more. Just imagine listening to the books that inspired movies like The Bourne Identity, Moneyball, or sci-fi classics like Dune. The best part? You can try Audible free for 30 days and get your first audiobook on them. It's a great way to experience storytelling while supporting this podcast. To get started, go to thenextreel.com/audible or text thenextreel to 500-500. Listen to incredible audiobooks and support the show today. That's thenextreel.com/audible. Welcome to Movies We Like, part of the True Story FM Entertainment Podcast Network. I'm Andy Nelson, and that over there is Pete Wright.
I'm Pete Wright.
On today's episode, we've invited dialect coach William Conacher to talk about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, a movie he likes. William, how are you today?
Excellent, thank you.
Well, we are thrilled to have you here on the show with us to talk about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which is a great, great movie. I can't wait to chat about it with you. Before we jump into that, though, I wanted to talk a little bit about you and being a dialect coach, like that whole idea of like that path in the industry and in life. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how you got started? It sounds like you went to the School of Speech and Drama. What was it that said, this is an area that I want to move into?
So I was an actor originally. Most dialect coaches I know have been, although there are some who've been speech and language therapists or drama teachers, but most I know have been actors. And then that course at Central School of Speech and Drama, you don't train as a dialect coach specifically, you train in voice more generally. And just when I was there, I met another dialect coach who was teaching us, who just really inspired me. And I didn't even know what that job was particularly. And I just thought, oh, right, yeah. I didn't know that was a thing and I can do that. And then really, really soon after I graduated, I was teaching at RADA, Royal Academy in London. I stayed there for 8 years and met some amazing people who kind of took me with them along the way. And, you know, that's how it all got started, really.
I look at your IMDb and it's just littered with some of my favorite properties. And I'm wondering how you go about learning the dialects that you're teaching others. What are the mechanics that go into that relationship?
Well, you know, it's really changed. So when I started, which was in 1876, there was no internet. And I literally used to have to get on, like I once got a bus around the west coast of Ireland, just taping people with my mini disc recorder, as it was then. You know,
school.
Just going into pubs and just recording people and breaking it down. In fact, one of the very first jobs I ever did was called The Rocket Post. And it was set in the Outer Hebrides, which is a little group of islands off the west coast of Scotland, where they speak in a very extraordinary way that nobody really knows. And, you know, you just go around trying to meet people, recording them. Now it's all on YouTube.
Sure.
You can pretty much get any clip you want right on the internet. But, you know, the process, once you've got the sample, is still the same. You break it down into component parts, because what you don't want an actor to do is just listen to something and try and copy the whole thing. It's one step at a time. You know, if you're listening for example, this morning, I was helping an Australian actor with a British accent. There was one diphthong, as we call it. That's a vowel made up of two different parts. O. he hadn't quite heard that right because he was listening to something and had got a little overwhelmed and was trying to fix everything and had missed the detail. When you get somebody to just go through and just concentrate on one thing, then gradually it falls into place. Once they fix one thing, it tends to be like dominoes, and then it triggers the muscle memory and they go, oh, okay, it feels like this. So well, it's about breaking it down into very, very small teachable components.
And I imagine, I mean, you know, actors are obviously, hopefully, a good group to be working with because they're very used to training themselves, their bodies to move certain ways, like the little moments that they can move and everything. And then I suppose with their mouth as well. But I mean, I imagine that like there is a huge difference, like when somebody says, okay, Southern accent, for example, we'll just use, but even in the scope of that, there's going to be a big difference between somebody with a Texan accent versus a Georgian accent versus an Arkansas accent, you know? And so I imagine trying to figure out for you, but then also how to separate that into each of those, you know, it is probably quite a trick, especially when they have an idea as to what, okay, a Southern accent sounds like.
Well, and also there are some, it's not just the different regions, it's also the time period. So
sure.
You know, yeah. I don't yeah. claim to be an expert on American accents. There are American coaches who do that much better than me, but it does come up. I just did a Kentucky accent with Paul Mescal for a project that's going to come out later this year. I don't really know the Kentucky accent, so I'm absolutely reliant on getting the authentic sample, and the story is set in 1912.
Wow.
So,
wow.
You know, yeah. Again, you can go on university oral history websites and there's a whole load of stuff there. So you just have to trust that you've got the right sample and make that your rock, wow. You know, because if I personally would get overwhelmed if I was sort of thinking, well, how can I tell the difference between Texas and Kentucky? You know, I just have to find the right person to listen to.
It's fascinating, though. I mean, you say you're not an expert in American accents, but I look at your catalog and I'm bouncing around from, you know, Mank to Spencer to No Time to Die to The Peripheral to Oppenheimer. Right? I wouldn't know from your catalog what your expertise is if there is a regional sort of dialectical expertise. How do you classify yourself?
Such a good question, which I've never been asked before. I mean, I suppose I try my best not to, is the truth. I'd like to think that given access to the most authentic sample, I can teach it, regardless of what it is. That's what yeah. I'd like to believe. There is a reasonable expectation, especially from people interviewing me in the US, that you might say, well, you must know the difference between all the Southern accents. I just want to be clear. I don't, and don't claim to.
neither do we.
The worst example for me to pull is something.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I knew the Oppenheimer voice because there's a lot of Oppenheimer that you can listen to of him making speeches, and we based it on the real one. Mank, I only did the Orson Welles character, and, you know, there's a lot of Orson Welles you can listen to.
Sure.
Peripheral, that was we had Chloe Grace Moretz in that, whose family come from that region, and so there was a lot of access we had to real people to listen to help Jack Rayner with that accent. Yeah.
And they sounded great.
It's all about getting the real people.
Well, and it's interesting because I think sometimes people go to films and don't actually know what it is they're hearing, or that they assume that they're hearing something without realizing it's intended to be something else. And I just remember, just as an example, and I don't think this is something that you worked on, but Blood Diamond with Leonardo DiCaprio, I remember people saying, oh, his South African accent is terrible. And then people came out later and said, well, he's not actually even South African. He's Rhodesian, which I think is now Zimbabwe. So it's like a totally different tone. And like that's, but I think in people's heads, like that's the thing that they latch onto, is they think that it's something without realizing that, you know, there's a whole world of accents out there.
No, that happens. And also I think that really well-known actors get a bad deal with things like that. If that hadn't been Leonardo DiCaprio, people wouldn't have been saying that.
Sure, probably.
People are waiting to catch people out, or they're so used to somebody's real voice that they're going, nah, that can't be it. you know, yeah. He's particularly amazing
yeah.
with accents, I think.
Are there others that I've heard Nicole Kidman is somebody who's great at accents. I know you've worked with her in the past. Are there particular people that you would say this person just really can latch onto the fine pieces of an accent?
The further you go down this road, you tend to work with the people who are really good at accents. Kate Blanchett's amazing at accents. Naomi Watts is amazing at accents. Rami Malek is amazing. I mean, I'm just so lucky with the people that I work
yeah. with. Rami Malek was, that was No Time to Die that you worked on.
And Bohemian Rhapsody.
And Bohemian Rhapsody. What was the accent in No Time to Die? It was just kind of, for me, it was just like a villain, but it's like I didn't know that it was a particular accent.
Well, yeah.
He does sound like a native villain, though.
At the time, we chose not to talk about it. So I think I'm allowed to talk about it now. We actually based it on Azerbaijan. We didn't want to go Russian.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we listened to people from Georgia and Azerbaijan and that kind of Caucasus region.
Okay.
And it is a little amorphous. You know, there's not a huge amount to hang your hat on there, but that was a deliberate choice on our part.
Sure.
We did want to do villain. We were specific, but without really saying to the audience, this is from a specific
nation state. Yeah.
So it sounds like we won there because you didn't know where he was from.
No, yeah, right.
Not a clue. He was terrific.
No, that's so interesting. Sometimes you also work as a dialogue supervisor. And I know like you've worked with Stephen Daldry a number of times, but I noticed like on Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, you're credited as having been a dialogue supervisor with Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, and Thomas Horn. It's, you know, American speaking kind of an American accent. What's the job of a dialogue supervisor in something like that?
Yeah. So I've got to be honest, that's a slightly made up title. that Stephen made up for me because it's what we refer to me as when I'm working on the post-production as well. I mean, you always do the ADR with the actors, but where there are certain relationships you have with certain directors where you're by their side through the mix. Mm-hmm. And that's when we refer to me as a dialogue supervisor because he likes me to give an opinion on things that are not just about accents, but about even the levels of the dialogue and the loop groups. And the reader was where we really first came up with it because there's a whole, apart from just doing the German accents, I did all the post and there's a whole level of real German that you can't hear because it's mixed so low. We just did it with the crowd.
I see.
So you would never as an audience be able to identify that there's actual German being spoken in a movie where everybody else is speaking English, but it gives a layer of authenticity that you couldn't say why, but it just is.
Yeah.
So you coach. Do you coach in other languages besides English?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay. The great thing, my age and of my experience is that you kind of arrive at a point where people are paying you for your taste. You know,
dare to dream.
That's not a boast of saying I have great taste. It's just that I've been around so long that I think by process of elimination, people trust your taste.
So I suppose that speaks to when you're working on somebody with like made up dialects, like you also worked with Peter Dinklage and Ben Barnes in The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian, and which isn't. You know, it's Narnia. Like when you're like, is that just like, we're just going to come up with something that sounds a little different.
It's quite funny that was, I must be honest. I'm not sure that if I was doing that movie now, I think I would probably try and be a bit stronger about imposing my supposedly great taste. At the time it was very much Andrew Adamson's concept that I can't remember the tribe. I think they're called the Telmarines. Oh God, I might be getting that wrong. But the tribe that Ben Barnes is the prince of should all have had a kind of Spanish-ish accent. Mm. And we spent about 8 weeks getting that ready in New Zealand. Then Andrew called me one day and said, listen, all of the other guys that I'm casting alongside him are going to be Italian. So can we switch to an Italian accent? I said, you know what? I really don't think you can ask him to do that after doing this for so long. Anyway, okay, well, no one will really know the difference. So we did end up, I must be honest, with a bit of a mishmash of kind of like Latin-esque
<You're right.
laughs> accents in the Narnia tribe. And then What really amuses me is that when Michael Apted then directed the next one, which is called Voyage of the Dawn Treader, he'd hated the accent so much, he just went, just don't do it. So Ben doesn't have the accent in the next one. I mean, you know, I think this is glorious. It's, you know, with hindsight, I can find that very funny.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
Sort of the converse of that. You have worked on Spencer, extraordinary film, and so much work on The Crown. I'm curious how you see your work on those properties in terms of sort of the dialects of the royals. Is there additional weight on the process because of who they are?
Definitely. I mean, The Crown is a really interesting one because none of us really knew what it was going to be. We knew we wanted to do six seasons. We knew there was a scope for telling decades worth of story. But we didn't really know how to calibrate the voice work, how much of a barrier it might be if they sounded very much like the real people. I was quite keen that they did sound as close to the real people as possible because I thought that it helped with the period. If they sounded like if you believed that they were in the 1950s, it gave you much more leeway to then tell the rest of the story going forward because the current Prince William, current Prince of Wales does not have the same accent as the late Queen. So, you know, I wanted those differences to be heard. But nevertheless, it was a risk, you know, to go quite as far as we did with, especially with Claire Foy and Vanessa Kirby. You know, it's quite, when you look back on it now, you think it was quite bold what we did, I think, to go that far. But what got easier was that everybody loved it. And so by the time you're doing season 2, 3, and the actors coming into it then went, oh, good, it's my chance to sound like that. But Spencer, yeah, that's a different thing because that was an American playing Princess Diana. Obviously, there's hurdles there that are different to get over. The fact that The Crown already existed. I have to say at this point, I have done 4 Princess Dianas. I did the Naomi Watts one, the 2 girls who played her in The Crown, and the Kristen Stewart one.
Wow.
That's it. There'll be no more.
So many Dianas. Really cornered the market.
No more Dianas. I'd say Spencer probably there was the most riding on that just because there was already such a body of work of people playing Diana. And in fact, Elizabeth Debicki was about to start right then as well at the same time. So, you know, there was a lot riding. Personally, I think Spencer's a very successful film because it doesn't really try and be as true to life. It's a little bit more of a kind of gothic allegory.
Fantastical.
Yeah. I love that element of that. I have to say it's one of my favorite projects I've ever worked on.
She's transformative in the role. Like there's nothing unbelievable, not even that sort of uncanny valley of dialect. Like I'm in the process so much with her in that movie. But what a screaming success.
One of the most extraordinary people I've ever worked with. It was a delight from the first day of prep to the last day of ADR. She's absolutely wonderful. Anyone who gets a chance to work with Kristen Stewart, do it.
We'll put her on our list.
Yeah, that's right. That's an interesting example because you're also working with a Chilean director on that film, and having that as an additional element in all of that, because, you know, Pablo is coming into the film not necessarily having the ear for the accent as much. So, like in a project like that, I guess, you know, I'd be curious, like walking through the process. I'm assuming there's probably quite a period during pre-production where you're working with the actor, helping them with the accent. Do you come on to set also? And are you there on set to make sure that everything's coming out right? And is the director constantly looking to you? Like, did that sound okay? Or
yes to all of that.
Yeah.
Kristen and I started, I don't know, at least 3 months before, maybe, I can't remember now, maybe 6 months. And I was with Pablo all the time. We got on so well. I mean, I wouldn't say that he was nervous in any way about the way she sounded, but yeah, he would always, I mean, not just to me, he's just a very, very collaborative director and would look round to anyone who needed to really to say, sure. Are we all happy to move on?
Yeah, right. And then from that, you're also then potentially involved in post, as you said, with the ADR process coming in to help them. Yeah.
That's my favorite part.
Oh, really? Is it because it's just a little more confined and they have time to just kind of focus on just the voice?
Exactly. There's so much less pressure. And, you know, it's quite fashionable, I think, for directors and actors to say, oh, I hate ADR. But they don't really. I've seen so many performances improved by ADR. I've seen the actual dialogue improved.
They get to show up in sweats and hang out in a nice, cozy space for 12 hours.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they don't have to worry about the way they look.
Give us a swing, the most challenging dialects that you've had to teach.
Well, nobody's really saw that movie, The Rocket Post, but an Outer Hebridean accent is something you can't even believe it's English. So that's challenging. I did a film about football hooliganism called Green Street, where all of the cast were authentically London. And Elijah Wood was in it, and he's playing an American. And there's Charlie Hunnam was in it, who was the only non-London actor. And, you know, he did a great job, but it's hard when you're amongst a lot of people who were authentic. You know, that was a challenge to make him meld with the rest of the cast.
Okay, this brings up something that I'm constantly stymied by when you say they're authentically London. What is authentically London? To my ear, there are 1,500 unique dialects in and around the London major metropolitan area. How do you even begin to isolate? Because they all seem to have a deep love of their own speech.
Correct. I mean, I don't know how many there are. It certainly isn't by region.
Right.
It's. I mean, I think that's probably somewhat true in the US as well, isn't it? That it's not necessarily down regional lines. It's around cultural lines. Young people tend to speak like other young people who listen to the same kind of music.
The only sort of parallel that I have is sort of New York, and a young New Yorker is going to sound like a New Yorker first, right?
Uh-huh.
And you can start to tell the difference between New York and New Jersey, right? You know, I grew up there, but I moved to the city, right? That kind of a thing. But I don't hear borough level accents when I'm in New York, right? I don't hear Queens versus Brooklyn versus the Bronx. And I'm not from there. I only did time. But my ear tends to be fairly flexible. And when I look at London sort of accents, the variety is astounding to me.
Well, that's true because it's mainly because we have so many different ethnicities and languages that influence it. That's mainly what makes everybody sound so different.
What is your you're speaking in your native accent? Would you call this your birth accent?
Probably not my birth accent. I was raised in the suburbs of London to the south, but because of my job and because I've traveled such a lot, and you know, it's been a long time since I've been a child in Surrey, I probably don't really sound that way anymore. Whenever I go to America, people ask me if I'm Australian.
Really?
Interesting. Interesting.
I think it's not because they actually think I'm Australian, it's just that I don't have the accent that people expect, whatever that is.
Whatever that is.
I don't know, but so it's pretty regular that I'm asked if I'm Australian.
Well, it is interesting because like my mom is Australian and she's been here in the States since, I don't know, 1970 or something, but she still has retained a small bit of accent and it is at a point where oftentimes people can't tell what it is. And I feel like a lot of people just throw out Australian as an option when they just don't. It's British-ish, but I'm not exactly sure what, so we'll just call it Australian.
I suspect you're right. If you don't quite fit the bill of what they're expecting,
right? Australian. Yeah,
don't be on Americans.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm just curious. Like, what is the? How do you start? Like, when? Okay, say Pete and I, you're going to be working with us to, let's just say, like Cockney, for example. Where would you start in saying, okay, let's work on helping you work with your Cockney accent? I mean, is it just strictly script-based? Do you look at the words on the script? Or are you saying, okay, but you need to understand the core essence of how you say certain things first?
Slightly depends on your level of experience. You know, so, like if I was starting with literally you from the get-go, then no, I wouldn't start with the script. We'd spend, you know, a good half an hour listening to a variety of different Londoners and trying to work out what the common denominators are. There are processes that I have with everybody or that I find useful for myself. For example, I like to watch. And that's the great thing about YouTube. You can watch these people speaking as well. I like to watch and listen. And then I like to just watch with the volume muted. Mm-hmm. See if there's anything physical you can identify about the oral posture, the way they use the lips and the cheeks. And is there something in that? Probably if we were watching Cockneys, mm-hmm. you'd notice that compared to an American accent, there's a lot more movement in the jaw. Like it's a lot more, you use your mouth a lot more than an American would. So that would probably be where we start, the physicality of it.
Okay.
And how that might affect, in a Cockney accent, particularly the diphthongs. It's O, ow, A, I. That's a great one, actually. I. Fly.
I.
Fly. Getting a train. No, I'm going to fly.
I'm going to fly.
Oh, that's so good.
That starts sounding Australian in my head, though.
Oh, but you know, all goes to Australia. I'll just bore you with that because you said fly. Your L is la, so you're saying fly. But this London L is fly, fla, fly.
Fly.
But in terms of the fly. It's the same.
Like yeah,
London,
right.
Fly. Australian, fly.
Fly.
The only difference is the L.
Fly. I can't do the fly. That's really hard.
I know. It's hard. It fly. Takes time. It takes really a lot of time.
Well, yeah. Because I feel like with the longer jaw, then it's more of full. I feel like it's turning into the Australian.
Face it, Andy, you're capable of two. You're capable of two accents. This one and your mother's Australian.
I've got the Monty Python.
Oh, like, right. We do also
my
have
British, my Monty British Python. Accent is like the Monty Python.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that.
Faux British.
Yeah. Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. I always say when I'm working on the dialogue with the actors and they said, do you mind reading the other people? I went, I will, but you just need to know that I make everything sound like Monty Python. So as long as you're prepared to play your scenes with Monty Python, that's fine.
Oh, that's so funny. It's fantastic.
This is just going to be a question about how your brain works, because I'm so interested in sort of neuronal development about how you keep these things straight. I actually, as we're talking, I found a map of British English dialects, and I am surprised to see how small Cockney is, just like Black Country and Brummie and Coventry and Corbyite. These tiny little isolated islands.
I don't even know what that one is.
It is in the middle of the North Ents dialect between Cambridges and West Midlands, north of London. This is it. It is.
Wow. Okay. There you go. You see, this is what I mean. I'm not an expert until I'm an expert. You know.
That's exactly it.
Until somebody's asked me to coach that, and I've gone to find it.
Right.
When you think about accents, particularly when you're working in properties that have accents that are adjacent to one another but distinctly different, let's just say Australian and Kiwi, right? How are you able? Do you have any tricks to be able to get yourself in, get it in your ear from one to the other?
It isn't really tricks. I mean, the Australian. Once you know what the difference is between an Australian and a New Zealand accent, you can never really unhear it. Fish in New Zealand would say fush. Once you know, you're listening for vowel sounds. It's like map references. Once you've walked north in New York a couple of times, you won't ever go wrong.
Yeah, right. You get it. You know, right.
It's
a grid.
Map references. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'll credit this to Kristen Wiig. I think it was Kristen Wiig who said she has, whenever she needs to do an Australian accent, she just says, Reese Witherspoon. And that always immediately gets her into the accent.
Great. I went with her. I went with her on A Boy Called Christmas.
What was her accent?
Kind of comedy British.
Comedy British. Now that's a whole other level of, is that kind of moving into the Monty Python realm?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
It's a very underrated cute movie, that I think, A Boy Called Christmas. It's very good.
Have not seen it.
What is the, you know, the trick in I can't remember the movie, but where they're talking about Michael Caine and how you say his name is, you say Michael Caine, and that's like how he says his name. But that's that little.
I don't know. I've never seen that.
Okay, well, it's just, but it's funny because like that's how I get my head, like Michael Caine's accent, into my head, Michael Caine.
You wouldn't say the L.
Yeah.
Michael Caine. Yeah. Oh my God, it works.
You didn't know this was a learning podcast, did you?
Oh, I'm so glad it is. I'm always happy to learn new things.
So funny.
One more. As much as I want this not to be, we'll turn to Ferris Bueller and not make this just a litany of your credits. But one of the things that we have done on this show, or on one of the other shows we do, The Next Reel, is an entire series on the movies of Robin Hood. And you worked on the 2018 Robin Hood, and I am so curious.
Okay.
Your take. Okay, I'll stop. I'll stop and let you go.
Well, no. To be fair to myself, I worked for about a week that movie.
Not a lot of time.
Not a lot of time. This is the honest truth. I was asked by Jamie Dornan, who I've worked with a number of times, to help him. And then when I got there, he pretty much decided with the director to just do his own voice.
Oh, okay.
And then I met Taron for about 2.5 minutes, and we both agreed that he was marvelous and didn't need any help. And there were other people I met who I had a really lovely time. Like, I spent the afternoon mucking around with Jamie Foxx. And his accent. And he is one of the most delightful people I've ever met as well. So playful and fun. And that is also where I met Ben Mendelsohn, and also for about 3 minutes. And I also met Eve Hewson, who I have gone on to do an awful lot of work with. Actually, Eve Hewson is Bono's daughter and a great actor. And she has this very successful show, Bad Sisters, on Apple, in which she's tremendous. And a beautiful movie called Flora and Her Son.
It's been doing John Carney.
Yeah.
John Carney's mm-hmm.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. So I had a lovely time working on Robin Hood, but in terms of like...
It sounds like it was because it was more of a tourist visa to the set.
Yeah, to be honest, yeah. I mean, it was quite ill-fated, that movie. I can't remember all the things that happened, but I think at one point their set burned down.
Yeah, it was troubled.
I think all sorts of things went wrong for them on that movie.
Well, everything
the
exploded.
The best Robin Hood movie is unquestionably the Disney cartoon where he's a fox.
1970, yeah.
that's easily the best Robin Hood.
The canonical truth.
Although Cary Elwes does have the line, you know, I'm the only one who can speak British, which I always thought very funny in Robin Hood Men in Tights. So. Well, yeah, this has been such an interesting journey into language and the way that you work with people with dialect. But let's shift our attention to the movie that brought us here and brought us together, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, directed by John Hughes.
I said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
What is so dangerous about a character like Ferris Bueller is he gives good kids bad ideas.
Why should he get to skip school when everybody else has to go?
Syphilitic meningitis.
He never gets caught.
This guy in my biology class said that if Ferris dies, he's giving his eyes to Stevie Wonder.
Well, he's very popular, Ed.
I recall Central Park in fall.
Ferris Bueller, do you know him?
Yeah, he's getting me out of summer school.
They think he's a righteous dude.
Think he'll be alive this weekend?
I can see him denying popular beliefs, setting off on some impossible mission.
He jeopardizes my ability to effectively govern this student body.
He does whatever he wants.
You know, as long as I've known him, everything works for him.
Whenever he wants.
He's very cool.
And he never gets nailed.
Ferris can do anything.
Oh, he's such a sweetie.
Wake up and smell the coffee, Mrs. Bueller. It's a fool's paradise. He is just leading you down the primrose path.
Matthew Broderick.
Bueller. Ferris Bueller.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Because life is too beautiful a thing to waste.
This is a fantastic film. 1986, this film came out. Do you remember your first time coming to this film and why it stuck with you?
Oh, not really. I feel like I've seen it so many times. It's been part of my life. Let's think, how old was I in 1986? 18. I honestly can't remember the first time I saw it, but I just feel like it was part of that era of Breakfast Club, and it was those 1980s movies that were so funny. can't remember the first time I saw it. No, but it's part of, it's absolutely part of the infrastructure of my movie life.
Is there anything in here related to dialect work that sparks interest in you in this movie?
Absolutely none.
Okay. I was worried a little bit that we were going to come in here and get ready for a dissertation, a treatise on the variant dialects in and around Chicago.
I'm afraid not. I just love those. Although, actually, I was a bit geeky because I can, in a way that I absolutely didn't do in 1986, but when I was watching it again to get ready to speak to you today, I thought, oh, Alan Ruck really has a... as an accent. And he's from Ohio, I saw. So I can hear that now with, in a way that I didn't in 1986. What I think that I love, there's so many things I love about that movie, but I just love characters speaking directly to the audience. It's just one of my favorite things. I don't think you see it often enough. And I love it that it's he's so disciplined, because it's very important that it's only Ferris who does it. Lots of those characters speak to themselves, like Principal, forgot his name. Principal.
Rooney, yeah.
Rooney, thank you. And Cameron speaks to himself, but they're genuinely speaking to themselves for real, kind of musing, whereas Ferris directly addresses us, and I just love that.
And the fact that he does it in a way throughout the movie, not just to talk to us, but to use us as a witness, to bear witness to the things that he's doing. The sequence around the hot tub is perfect. When he's having the argument with Cameron and what did you see today? Nothing good. He looks at the camera and doesn't even say anything. He's like, can you believe what you're hearing right now? Just such precision character work.
And Broderick's genius at it.
Yeah, because, for some people, like, looking into the lens is not an easy thing. Like, it is a strange thing to have to look into that eye that is just staring at you. And it can be a little uncomfortable. And being the one who's constantly interacting with it and looking at it, and it's like, it's your, compatriot, your, as you said, your witness. It is, like, so natural for him to do often throughout this film. Like, from the get-go, he's doing it all the way to after the credits.
And I love it that, it just makes the character so, voiceover is used a lot, but there's the sort of accepted wisdom of voiceovers ever since Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven film is that voiceover should be distanced. It's a non-emotional, uninvolved voice, which I think is right. But the great thing is that speaking directly in the second circle to the camera is both voiceover and character and emotional. It has so much scope. It's a great tool. Should be used more.
I think a lot of that also speaks to how effortlessly it feels that John Hughes actually directs comedy, like with the camera throughout this. Like, I really was noticing on this watch just how funny the way that his camera work is, like whether it's a perfectly timed close up or just the right pan to a particular thing happening. Like, John Hughes gets it into the right place at the right time.
There's so many funny push-ins and things that maybe we're used to seeing now, but my favorite camera work is where that you don't see Rooney until they linger for ages just on his nameplate on the desk, and you hear him on the phone, but you just know what's coming just because of that nameplate.
Yeah,
it's a very, very clever film.
Yeah, really is. It's funny, when I first saw this, I was a little bit of the person who looked at, like, ditching school as, like, such a, you shouldn't do that. Like, I had a hard time getting into this movie when I was younger. And it wasn't until I was older that I really was like, I could get it and I could appreciate what the film is doing. But now, like, watching it, I also really was feeling like there is this element to this story about Ferris also being fairly intuitive with his friend. Alan Ruck's character is going through a lot of hard times right now. His parents are fighting in divorce. He clearly is having issues with his dad. He seems, especially as we kind of get toward the end, like, is there this element of suicidal nature to him? And there's this part of the story that I really found just really touching in the way that Ferris almost like recognizes that and decides to take this day off. I know he doesn't come out and say it ever, but it's really like, I want to be there for Cameron and give him this day to really show what joy there is in life. And there is something, there's this element to that, that I guess I really hadn't clicked with before, but I found it this time. And it's just like, I don't know, I found it so much more of an important message on this watch.
And don't you think it's a running theme in John Hughes' work, in the writing and the films, that it leads you into thinking that it's about children outwitting adults, but ultimately it's about children learning something about their relationship with each other.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of the same as Home Alone, isn't it? You know, look,
certainly Breakfast Club.
He speaks to it all the time. Yeah. He speaks to the camera all the time, and you think it's about him getting one over on Joe Pesci and those guys, but actually, ultimately, it's about him learning about his own relationship to his family.
Yeah.
It's the same theme in Ferris.
And his individuation, right? What he's capable of. And in Ferris Bueller, you know, he already knows what he's capable of as a person. Like, he initiates all of these things because he has such supreme confidence. But Cameron and Sloane don't yet, right? They're dragged along and realize as a result of this wonderful day what they are capable of seeing in the world, of the joy of the independence of the, in Cameron's case, confrontation and ownership of his identity with his father that we never see play out, you know, which is, I guess, great, but there's a little insidious part of me that wants that movie too. Like, I'd love to see Cameron individuate properly from his dad. But this, I mean, so much of this movie is about them coming to terms with who they are as young adults.
And you don't see that coming, I don't think.
No.
It's really quite dark, that scene with Cameron kicking the car. In a way that I'd forgotten how, it's really quite upsetting in a way that I could never have guessed was coming.
That's another sort of sleight of hand trick that John Hughes is capable of doing, unlike so many other writer directors, which is to take something, tell a very true dark story, and have us all remember it as a comedy. Reference The Breakfast Club. The Breakfast Absolutely. Club is an incredibly dark movie.
It's very dark,
and yet we remember it from our youth as like, oh, it was funny. It was about kids in detention. Same thing with this movie. Oh, it's about Ferris Bueller and he's in the parade and he's doing funny things and there's a great montage. And oh, also, it's about a suicidal kid who doesn't understand how to relate to his dad.
Yeah.
Very, very genius filmmaker. Breakfast Club is dark, though. Like,
right, it's proper dark. Right.
Yeah. That one, definitely goes down a much darker road. Yeah. But, you know, what I really enjoy just about the craftsmanship of this is like, we're given Ferris and his story as he's like, I'm going to take this day off. I'm going to get Cameron involved. We're going to hang out. I want to get my girlfriend over here so that Sloane is hanging out with us too. But then we also have like these other elements of the story that I enjoy so much, and particularly his sister. I really love Jennifer Grey as Jeannie, who's her quest is to bring her brother down. And she's like so mad that he always gets away with everything. And like, she's going to like, what can I do to do that? And it builds like, cause you got that story. And then you also have Principal Rooney, or the Dean of Students, I should say, as the one who's like, I'm going to finally get this kid. And I love how it all builds to that final moment at the back of the house when he, you know, he catches Ferris finally. And then his sister, like that's that final moment where his sister is able to like be there for her brother. And it's just like, what a moment. Like, she had been so ready to get him caught by the parents. And then that final moment, she
realizes why, yeah. what would it be for her?
Yeah. Right. And it's just like, what a touching moment between the brother and sister. And that's like, that's it. That was the final moment that we have between the two of them. But it's just like, it was such a perfect moment as she like lets him go back into the house to get into bed.
Well, lest we forget the lead into that, which I think is possibly one of the best lessons of this movie, which is in the police department, where she's having that conversation with the drug-addled cameo
Charlie Sheen,
yeah. Right? Which is him playing the ghost of Christmas Future. So this line, everybody else has to go to school. Well, you could ditch. I'd get caught. Yes. You're pissed because he ditches and doesn't get caught. Is that it? Basically, your problem is you. Worry about yourself, not about what your brother does. That's just an opinion, right? That lesson right there is a central lesson to the movie, which is like you get to own your own identity. You don't have to make your identity slavishly tied to your brother just because he's what, more popular than you? Why do you have to do that? That allows so much of the family rebuilding at the end of this movie between siblings that I just find it, as an only child, I find it incredibly moving and aspirational that I'm sure all of my siblings would be like that.
No, that's what it's about. The movie's about individuality.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I was also struck on this rewatch by how genius the costume is. The costume design is so clever. Mm. Just from that, you know, that robe he's in at the beginning and the way he puts his hair in that towel, he's coming down the corridor, and the fact that he's wearing that sweater vest all the way through, and then suddenly you realize that when he gets on the carnival float with the German girls, their costume colors are the same. You think, oh yeah. My yeah. God, it's brilliant. So clever. Yeah.
For sure. And Jeannie too is like a staple of the 90s, right? She's got her Nikes and her kind of like puffy socks or leg warmery type things and the tights and the colors and everything just feels so embodied in 90s pop culture.
80s, I would say.
80s, but yeah, right. What am I talking about?
They each definitely have that, right? Like they all feel... they're wearing elements that just feel kind of that era. And it feels like the things that youth would be wearing. But it also feels so casual. But you're right. When Ferris ends up on the float and everything, he ends up feeling like naturally a part of it. And that's it's kind of perfect.
So clever.
And weirdly, you can also buy him as the Sausage King of Chicago. Like, it's like there's something about that attitude that is with the outfit that is the sort of thing that you would say, sure, okay, yeah.
That's probably his boldest moment, isn't it, when he doesn't back down there?
Well, yeah, clearly it's a shock to Sloan and Cameron as they're like, no, let's just go. What you're pushing it too far. But yeah, really interesting. And it's one of those moments where you're kind of like, okay, this scene is going to end with the actual Sausage King of Chicago coming in at some point. And it doesn't happen. And I found that so interesting that John Hughes didn't feel he needed to give that to us. Like, we actually, like, they obviously have lunch and leave. Like, I guess the Sausage King never actually showed up for his lunch.
And the scene pays for that meal.
Well, I was wondering that. We don't get to see that, but at the end, the whole scene ends with him trying to hide from his dad, who's, you know, as we find out, is also his favorite restaurant, but which was a shift. So I enjoyed the way that plays.
That's another awesome bit of sleight of hand, the number of times that they duck out from under seeing dad and mom around town, right? In the cab and at the restaurant, it's all perfect.
And when he's racing home.
And racing home.
Yeah.
Classic.
Racing home one is a bit of a stretch.
You think?
Yeah.
That she never looks up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also when he's running right next to dad and it's like dad.
That one. Yeah. Yeah. But by then you're so in love with the movie. You just, you know, nothing you can do no wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
And in love with mom and dad. They're just sort of daffy, addled kind of like that. That's the John Hughes adult, right? They're not completely present, but they're present enough to be loving.
And it's really helped by the music. They have their own theme every time. There's some kind of
it's, the, it's exactly it's that loving love.
Yeah. It's so clever,
right? But you know what I love about John Hughes, like the parents in John Hughes films, not all of them. I think Breakfast Club, we don't really get to see them, but they're not necessarily this type of parent. But when you think of the parents here or something like 16 Candles, the parents do kind of have that daffy sense about them, but there is this sense of truly loving their kid and wanting to do what's best for their kid. And even Home Alone, right? It's like we have this sense of mom and dad here as, okay, sure, Ferris is kind of pulling one over on them in a very elaborate way when you get to see when mom comes home. But it's clear how much they actually love their kids, you know, and there is this sense of a real relationship with them, you know, just wanting to kind of create a good life for them. And I do enjoy that about what John Hughes does with the parents when they do pop up in the films.
Yes, because if they were, you wouldn't enjoy the child's cleverness and wiliness if they'd come from a bad home.
Right. Yeah.
So much. Would you? Right. I don't know.
It would just be sad.
Yeah. Isn't it just, he's just saying, have not yet accepted that there is a way to do things. They're still asking questions. They're still saying, well, why does it have to be like this? Why do I have to do that? That's what it's about. I think all of the children in his movies are just not accepting that there has to be a way to do things, and they're going to find their own way.
I think that's a good way of looking at it, because like Ferris has that bit about school, and he's just like, you know, European history is like, I'm not even European. Like he's got like this view of like why he shouldn't have to do that test. And, you know, sure, some people will actually latch onto that and want to become a historian and really kind of go down that path. But it is interesting how there are so many different things that you end up kind of having classes for over all the years of school that you do, that most of it you're not going to really be using at any point. And it's, you're right, it's, there is this level of kids figuring themselves out and like, what is it that I want to really be using out of all of this in my life?
I mean, I suppose it is worth saying, you know, in the context of today, it is rather privileged middle class kids.
Rather, yes.
Well, that's very true. Yeah. Like,
if you come from that kind of money, you know, maybe your test doesn't matter quite so much.
Yeah.
I think Ferris's future was fairly assured. And, you know, that house in Home Alone is something else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's John house, Hughes' yeah. money, right? Like, that's yeah. John yes. Hughes' identity is writing things. Pretty in Pink, same thing. Like, that's
yeah. Yeah.
That's just who these things are. You sort of have to accept that. Even National Lampoon's Vacation, right, Christmas Vacation is a classic of the, like, rich suburbanite who, you know, oove.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it any less enjoyable, but
nope.
You know,
nope, but it's good to be aware.
In the context of today, it is worth not feeling too worried about Ferris's future.
Right, yeah, he's going to be fine. Yeah. Yeah, right.
Well, I suppose that also, that's one of those elements that you don't see tackled often enough in his films, but Breakfast Club really does stand out in that regard as the one where he's really looking at all of these different groups in high school from different backgrounds. And yet at the core, they all are, you know, teenagers trying to figure life out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't have the list of names right off the top of my head, but the economics classroom, Ben Stein's classroom, is a who's who of faces that have gone on to other things, like not the least of which is Simone Christie Swanson, plays, I think, one of the iconic bit roles in this movie, just because she gets a great line and, you know, ends up as Buffy. Weird.
and how well cast are those teachers? Like droning. It's so genius.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, sure. It was really funny to, you know, eventually have Ben Stein have his own game show, like Win Ben Stein's Money, because like I was like, God, he was this character. Like, I didn't think of him as anything else other than Bueller. Like, that's just and that became iconic. Like, you could just, like, in class, you would just, like, teachers would be calling names and somebody would go Bueller. Like, it's
my understanding is that Ben Stein, he was such a wonk in the 60s, right? I mean, and worked for Nixon and was a classmate with Carl Bernstein. And like, he was a speechwriter, right? A Republican, conservative speechwriter. And my understanding was so much of his economics, like, he just did that. I think that was like what he would be teaching if he were teaching that high school class. And that's one of the things that makes it so funny. Yeah, no, he graduated from Columbia with honors in economics and was valedictorian of his class in Yale Law School. So he's right brilliant in his own right, and also ends up being one of the most entertaining, you know, sort of comic straight man actors that, you know, of the era.
That's got to be one of the most unusual journeys.
Yeah.
Ever.
Right?
Yeah, truly. Another regular that we have with John Hughes is Edie McClurg, who is the secretary for Dean Rooney, who is like, she is just like, generally my brain goes to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with her in her whole scene that she does with Steve Martin. But this movie, like, I forgot how much I enjoyed the relationship between her and Rooney, as far as like the way that he would just have these little like nasty cuts toward her for being such an idiot and a dingbat sometimes. And the way that she just so casually plays it, like she plays that kind of dingy secretary stereotype to a T.
Except she's not. That's one of the fun things about that character is that it lulls you into thinking she's going to be an idiot. Yeah. She's not at all.
Right. Right. She sees around every corner.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's so interesting. He's the dean of students, but she is so in tune with everything that's actually going on. Like, that's what is really interesting with her character. It's like she knows who's hanging out with who and it's got the whole lay of the land.
Absolutely.
Let's see. We've talked about a wide variety of the cast. Jeffrey Jones is an interesting, certainly a troubled person at this point in time, but he was kind of that face of Rooney that his role in a lot of these types of films, I think just kind of like this film became so iconic for him. But just like he's one of those people that I always think of in a lot of these 80s properties like this and Beetlejuice. And even going into like not so great movies like Howard the Duck, but it's like there's something about the way that he would perform. And just like it's clear he revels in being the antagonist in this film.
Absolutely. But he plays it so beautifully. He doesn't ever cross into that kind of mustache twirling element. The dilemma feels very, very real for him always.
The parallel story for Jeannie and Principal Rooney is the fascinating one, because she's the child and yet she learns the lesson of like being able to focus on herself that he never learns because of adulting, right? He's in a position where he has to be a completely zealous kind of authoritarian in his own mind, right? And he can't he can't get over the fact that this one student has just gotten under his skin, just like Jeannie has to get over the fact that her brother got under her skin. And I think that's really fascinating. Another John Hughes-ism that we're talking about, right? Giving the child the chance to outgrow the adult on screen. I think that's,
it's too late for Rooney, right?
It's too late. Rooney, yeah.
He doesn't learn.
He doesn't get to. So this movie is like a testament to, we are who they grow beyond, right? Like that's John Hughes' stock and trade. And
that's Rooney, a great way of putting it. Yeah.
Rooney is the testament to that.
Say that again.
I stole it. It's from Star Wars. It's a Yoda line who says it to Luke in the last Star Wars movie. They're looking at the tree burning and he says, "We are who they grow beyond," right? Like, and that is like, that's an anthem line, right? That's what parents do. And such a great way to find peace.
Yeah.
Let's revisit that Star Wars movie. It's obviously better than I thought.
Well, there's a scene that you could revisit. let's be honest. I'm sure it's on YouTube. I'll send it to you.
Right, yes.
Ferris Bueller, Andy, tell me it won all the awards.
This was not one of those movies that you think of as an awards winner, like when it comes time to the award circles. Granted, it's 1986, not nearly as many awards categories. It had three wins with one other nomination. At the Golden Globes, this was the only award at the time of its release, was the best performance by an actor in a comedy or musical for Matthew Broderick, but he lost to Paul Hogan in Crocodile Dundee.
No. Flag on the field. Sweet holy Jesus, Andy.
It is what it is. What can
Paul
I say?
Paul Hogan.
That's not a
It was a funny. This it was a funny knock. Movie. Who's talking about Crocodile Dundee today? Who is it?
I don't know.
Besides your mother.
At the National Film Preservation Board. See, that was the only one at the time of its release. So these other ones, like 2014, the National Film Preservation Board listed it on its registry of films. And then in 2021, the Online Film and Television Association put it in their Film Hall of Fame. And likewise in 2024, they put Ferris Bueller in their Character Hall of Fame. But that's it. That's it for awards.
There's one more award that you missed, and it's really important. It is the award of Best Pop Punk Ska Band Based on a Film. And that is the classic Save Ferris, which I listened to a lot. Save Ferris, the band. Were you a Save Ferris fan?
That's funny. No, I wasn't.
Oh, you totally should have been. This was back when it was cool to like ska. And I was that guy. So I loved Save Ferris. And they're back now. They're back. They broke up. And in 2016, 17, they came back. And we're all better for it. I think that's the truth.
Interesting. I didn't know they came back.
They came back, Andy.
Wow.
How did it do at the box office? So it didn't win the awards. Did it win all the money?
Well, it did. For Ferris, John Hughes had a budget of $5 million, or almost $14.5 million in today's dollars. The movie premiered June 11th, 1986, opposite Back to School, The Manhattan Project, and the limited release of Mona Lisa. Ferris couldn't quite push ahead of Rodney Dangerfield and landed in the number two spot for its opening weekend, and it never got higher than that. Still, it was a hit at the box office, earning $70.1 million domestically and $576,000 internationally for a total gross of $204.4 million in today's dollars. That landed the film in the number 10 spot in the highest grossing films domestically of 1986. All told, it ended up with an adjusted profit per finished minute of $1.8 million.
I love Back to School, but I'm not talking about that one today either.
Sorry, Rodney.
Just saying. Crocodile Dundee.
You know, I mean, so much of this movie has become iconic. I think hearing Yellow's Oh Yeah is another of those iconic bits that became like an almost like an anthem through the 80s and even into the 90s. Like, it's so defining of like when you hear it starting up, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing. The entire soundtrack is amazing, right? Like it's one of those movies that used the soundtrack of the music I was listening to at the time. So that we get Yellow, we get Ziggy Ziggy Sputnik, we get Big Audio Dynamite, we get a bunch of Dream Academy, which is fantastic. We get the Smiths, we get like those were the, with the exception of Wayne Newton, those were the songs I was listening to. And so it felt like, oh, they made this movie for me, right? How much credibility this movie has because it was speaking the musical language of me, a kid who was kind of at that point.
He used a little Brits, didn't he? In the soundtrack.
Yeah, right.
And you have to admit, even if you weren't, if Wayne Newton wasn't in your musical library at the time, at least after this film, you were probably singing Donkey Shane.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic. It's a great soundtrack. And that's, I think, another element that John Hughes really taps into with his films is finding the music that, like, I don't know, is John Hughes, I mean, how old was he when he was making this? Because I feel like John Hughes tapped into his teenage brain and just stayed there, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I believe that he died at the end of the 90s, and I think he was around 60. So
yeah, he was born in 1950.
Oh, okay.
35, 36,
making this, yeah.
Yeah.
He died in 09. That was, I thought he died much earlier.
When did he die?
2009.
Oh, really? I thought it was earlier than that.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But just like, I mean, 36 years old making this film, but he is like, really, like the music, as Pete said, it just feels so much what you are listening to. You know, and I'm sure he had a great music supervisor helping him with that. But I just feel like just how he taps into the teenage psyche through all of these films that he ends up tapping into. It's just like, I feel like there was something in John Hughes that really was able to find that element that was in a teenager of somebody who is trying to figure themselves out. And maybe that was just John Hughes. Like, he was maybe trying to figure himself out, but he recognizes that, and it creates this honesty in all of the teenagers that he ends up, no matter how far down the road of comedy the film goes, there's just this honesty in those characters that he really taps into.
What year was Donnie Darko? Donnie Darko owes a lot to...
Huh, that's interesting.
Not as a genre in its actual content, but the vibe of the school,
and the
way the authenticity of the teenagers and the way they're written, I feel those echoes of John Hughes.
Even tapping into like the music, I mean, Tears for Fears, it definitely like a little a little older, but still, it just, that music just kind of still felt like he was tapping into something with that youthful spirit in that, in Donnie Darko.
It's one of the sad transitions, right? That we end up with, I think, the spiritual successor to John Hughes ends up being somebody like Joss Whedon, who has, you know, such a vibe of, you know, such an ability to create a high school vibe, and also the inability to say I'm sorry, which is really sad, right? Like that, I think there's a lot of promise in making great comedy and authentic, telling stories of authentic youth that we've sort of lost. I don't know who's doing that right now.
Like, who's taken on the mantle of telling those stories?
Yeah. I mean, maybe Greta Gerwig in some way, you know, has sort of a voice of contemporary youth. But again, like, Barbie wasn't high school.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I don't feel like they're teenagers in her stories, you know?
Did you see that Australian movie last year that I've, of course, forgotten the name of, where they're doing the Ouija board?
Oh, talk to me.
That was very good about youth, I thought. I really believed all those.
Huh. Okay. Yeah,
very true. Yeah, very true. Although my brain says that they're more college age, but still, like, there's still something that's very authentic about that group of people. And just like the way they hang out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a mix of ages, younger brothers, and
yeah,
there are a range of ages in it.
Yeah.
I think the eighth grade is one that was extraordinary, but not as funny as I kind of needed it to be. Like, it was not John Hughes funny. It was more, oh, goodness.
That's quite upsetting.
It's really very upsetting. Really,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Very much.
Book smart. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. In that one, they really do speak to a lot of the authentic voice of the teenage characters as they're hitting that point of graduating and going separate ways and everything.
These are individual films, though, aren't they? So maybe Greta Gerwig is Ladybug. Maybe is the.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe she is the one who's sort of like consistently.
I might put Tina Fey on that list, but really Tina Fey just keeps making Mean Girls. I don't know if that counts.
Yeah.
Mean Girls. That's another great one.
Yeah. Right.
The great one.
But you're right about, you know, Greta Gerwig with Lady Bird, and then even, I mean, Little Women is a period piece, but still, like, speaking to the voice of young people, I still think that she was capturing it pretty well in that film. So,
yeah,
maybe there is something there.
There we are. We've decided, gents. Greta Gerwig is.
I think we just won movies. Yeah, Greta Gerwig is the next John Hughes. Yeah. You're welcome, Internet.
Oh my gosh. Did either of you ever watch any of the Ferris Bueller TV show that was a spinoff of this in 1990?
Mercifully, no.
No, but I did watch Parker Lewis Can't Lose, which was kind of a spinoff of a spinoff, unrelated, like spiritual cousin.
That's funny, because I didn't see the Ferris Bueller TV show. It only lasted a season, or like 13 episodes, so not even, wasn't received very well. But it's funny that you mentioned Parker Lewis Can't Lose, because weirdly, that actually feels like something that would be a spiritual sequel, because that one was it had a very kind of like active camera, very alive sort of storytelling that they used in that.
Absolutely did. And Corin Nemec went on to better stuff. And Abe Benrubi was the inaugural guest on this very show a few years back. Yes. And so, you know, I have a fondness for Parker Lewis.
Yeah, that was a
fun. Why has Ferris Bueller never been a Broadway musical? Or has it?
That's a great question.
I don't believe it has. But, you know, frighteningly, they are actually talking about a spinoff of this called... what is it called? Sam and Victor's Day Off, focusing on the two valets who took Cameron's father's car on a joyride. It's currently in development, and I just don't know what to say about that.
Oh, no.
Please don't make that.
No, you guys. I know.
Why? Why? Why can't they just let a property be just its own thing? Yeah.
They're great, those guys, that you only see them for like 2 minutes.
They tell we don't.
Clear story. And
it's perfect.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised the movie isn't like, that, you know, Genie decides to take a day off too, the sequel. Like it's kind of that level of
such exposition. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know John Hughes talked about doing a sequel at some point about like maybe it's in their college years and we'd see what they're up to in college. But I don't know. I just feel like the right heads prevailed in not actually making a sequel. It's like it shouldn't have a sequel. This is one of those things that just like it shouldn't even have had a TV spinoff. Like it should just be its own thing, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's why it stood the test of time, precisely because of that.
Yeah. Nobody ever figured that out.
Right. Yeah.
Great film.
Well,
great film.
William, it has been so fun talking to you about this film.
It's been excellent. You guys are amazing. You've got such greater knowledge than I do about all the people that were in it.
Well, we're fans. You picked an easy hitter, right?
Like, yeah, it's not a hard one to talk about.
No, it's not a hard one to talk about, but you definitely have superior knowledge to me.
Well, it was really fun. Thank you so much. Do you have any places online where, like, any socials or any place you direct people to, like, interact with you? Or are you kind of like, no, I am.
You can interact with me on Instagram. It's easy to find me. It's a public account. It's just William Conacher. There's not very many interesting things on there, but people are welcome to contact me on there if they want. DM me. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, fantastic. Well, I mean, keep up the great work. I mean, what projects do you have that are coming out soon for people to keep an eye out?
On Christmas Day this year is Robert Eggers' Nosferatu, which is an epic, epic labor of love. It's going to be amazing. It's properly scary in a very old-fashioned way.
And who are you working with on that, and what are the accents that we should be listening for?
They're both just regular, you know, it's a silly thing for a dialect, I should say regular British, you know, like, non-regional British accents with Lily Rose Depp and Willem Dafoe.
Oh, okay.
So we're not getting into like, I don't know, Transylvanian sort of things or Romanian?
There is one Transylvanian accent. Yes, not me. That was done before. My work on it is the RP with those two. And what else?
You did the Angelina Jolie project that's coming out.
Colors, right? Yes. Yeah. Maria. No, wait, what did I decide to call it? Maria, it's going to be called.
Just Maria.
Gotcha. I actually don't know the release date for that, but that's another Pablo film.
He has moved into directing some incredible stories about incredible women, so I cannot wait to
this is the final one. This is the final part of his trilogy of iconic women.
So from Jackie to Spencer to Maria.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
So good.
I'm sure there's something else I've done as well. Oh, yeah. I just did a film version of Hedda Gabler.
Oh.
Ibsen play with Tessa Thompson and Nina Hoss, that Nia DaCosta directed. I think that's going to be very interesting. That's early days. We only wrapped it at the end of February, so I haven't seen anything. But,
and what was, you were working with Tessa on that one?
I was.
And what in what accent would that be? So
kind of 1950s British.
Yeah.
They updated the story and put it in England.
Kind of a British hipster retelling of Hedda Gabler.
No, I wouldn't know. Not hipster. No, it's the claustrophobia of Ibsen's play relocated to an English country house in the 50s.
Not hipster.
Okay. No.
No.
Interesting. And then you said there was a Paul Mescal project that you just worked on as well, right?
That's called The History of Sound. That's directed by Oliver Hermanis. It's Josh O'Connor and Paul Mescal. It's kind of road movie about two guys who are passionate about music, collecting folk songs.
Wow.
In the rural Northeast.
Awesome.
Well, it's fair to say you're keeping busy. There are a lot of projects that you're going to be attached to, which is going to be exciting to see. So everybody check for those when they release near you. Again, William, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Such a treat.
Thank you very much for having me.
And for everybody else out there, we hope you like the show and certainly hope you like the movie like we do here on Movies We Like. Movies We Like is a part of the True Story FM Entertainment Podcast Network and the Next Reel family of film podcasts. The music is Chomp Clap by Out of Flux. Find the show at truestory.fm and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Letterboxd at The Next Reel. Learn about becoming a member at thenextreel.com/membership. And if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, we always appreciate it if you drop one in there for us. See you next time.